May it please the court, Ms. Rittman. Respondent's conduct in this discipline case involved the duty that he owed to his clients to safekeep his clients' funds that had been entrusted to him as fees and expenses in numerous bankruptcy cases. It was the respondent's duty to properly manage the trust account, to assure that the funds in that trust account were kept safe, and to complete client work in a timely manner. He failed to fulfill these duties on numerous occasions. The case was heard by the disciplinary hearing panel on a 20-count information. Two of the counts were dismissed at the hearing by the informant. The panel found violations of the rules of professional conduct as to the remaining 18 counts. The panel found violations of the safekeeping property rule 4-1.15 in 14 different counts. The panel found violations of rule 4-8.4C, conduct involving dishonesty, in 7 different counts. The panel found violations of rule 4-1.3 for diligence in not completing client work in these bankruptcy cases on 8 different counts.
Can you clarify something for me about the counts? I know he joined the firm later and then was an associate at first and then a partner. Are you saying he was responsible once he became a partner or the whole time he was with the firm, and which arose when?
Sure, Judge Smith, the relevant time frame for all of these charges is August 2013 forward, when he became a partner with Mr. Ray in August of 2013.
And are these cases that were filed after that point, or he assumed responsibility for checking the billing for, or a mix of both?
These were clients who, I think with one exception, these are all clients who retained the respondent and paid the fee to the respondent after August 2013. That time, Mr. Ray, who had suffered a stroke in 2012, was virtually out of the law firm. Not involved in the day-to-day activities of the law firm. He didn't have one transaction with a trust account, a $300 withdrawal in September of 2013. Every other transaction with the trust account was by the respondent. There was also a two-count finding by the panel of a violation of Rule 4-8.1C, failing to cooperate with the disciplinary authority. I think it's relevant to point out to the court the disciplinary history involved here. Respondent was admonished in 2006 for a violation of 4-1.16 for failing to return a client file at the termination of a representation. And most significantly, in 2009, this court issued a state suspension with probation to the respondent for various trust account violations, commingling of personal funds with client funds, providing financial assistance to a client in connection with pending litigation, failing to diligently represent clients, failing to withdraw from a representation after being discharged, and failing to cooperate with the disciplinary authority. While on probation, respondent received extensive training regarding the handling of the trust account. He was discharged by this court after a successful completion of the probation in April of 2012. Just over a year later, by August of 2013, he's accepting fees from clients and withdrawing those fees from the trust account before doing the work for these bankruptcy clients, to the point that by January 30th of 2014, his trust account has $347 in it, even though he's accepted fees from, at that point, around 10 of these clients who are charged in the information.
Mr. Pretz, I'll ask opposing counsel too, but as I read his brief, part of his explanation for his conduct was he talks about up until 2010, flat fees were acceptable and you earned the money given right up front before you did the work. That was no longer true at the time in question. Would that have been something that would have been talked about in the trust account seminars you're talking about? In other words, does he have a basis for arguing he misunderstood what the rules were and thought that was okay, although it was not? Or is it your position that he knew that it was not okay any longer? And
so I think by that time, Judge Stith, by 2013, formal opinion 128 had issued from the advisory committee. The training that he received from ethics school, going to solo and small firm conference, I assume there was never mention, never made after in the period of probation that these flat fees were earned upon receipt. That rule was, to the extent, I wouldn't even call it a rule, that decision by legal ethics counsel at the time by that time had already been abrogated. There was, and correctly so, in formal opinion 128. Flat fees are not earned upon receipt. They're not earned until the work is performed.
No, I know that. I wanted you to respond to what I took as part of the argument in the respondent's brief that may have been that there was a misunderstanding as to the appropriateness.
I wouldn't think it would be a reasonable misunderstanding, I guess, is the position of the informant. The fact is that there, I believe that there were cash flow problems based on the record evidence, based on respondent's brief, cash flow problems at the Bloom and Ray law firm, and I believe that the respondent addressed those cash flow problems by dipping into the trust account. And the fact is that that's not a misunderstanding, that's simple misappropriation and failing to safekeep those funds. Respondent mentions 8.4C and the fact that there has to be an affirmative representation made to the client regarding where those funds are going to be deposited in order for there to be a 4.4-8.4C violation for our misrepresentation, fraud, dishonesty. And I just think that's a total misreading and misunderstanding of this court's decisions as well as the plain language of the rule itself. Clearly, this court has found 8.4C violations in cases where there have been no representations made to the client regarding where those funds are going to be deposited. The fact is that obligation to safekeep and be honest with the client's funds arises from the fiduciary responsibilities that the lawyers owe to their clients, not from any representations made. So the reliance on civil fraud elements in the brief of a respondent to me is totally misplaced. This court in Ehler made very clear that there was an 8.4C violation by the simple fact of commingling. And I think 8.4C uses the word dishonesty apart from fraud and misrepresentation. So clearly 8.4C is violated simply by misappropriating those funds. In addition, obviously 1.15 is violated by the fact that these funds were not safe kept and were withdrawn prior to being earned and prior to these bankruptcy cases being filed. To an extent, the respondent blames Mr. Ray for his problems, saying that there was supposed to be some sum of money transferred from the Ray trust account to the Bloom and Ray trust account. I just want to make clear to the court that the charges in this case are all pertain to a time period when the respondent was in charge of the trust account, August 2013 forward, and that if in fact there was some failing on the part of Lawrence Ray to transfer funds into the Bloom and Ray trust account, the inappropriate way to handle that was by dipping into the trust account and using client funds to make up for the lack of deposits. As I said, every failing to entrust to safekeep these funds was during a period when the respondent was responsible for this trust account, even though both of them were signatories on the trust account. It's important to realize that blaming someone who was not actively part of the firm at that point was not factually correct and legally doesn't stand up against this court's decision in the Ferris case. In terms of sanction, I would point the court to ABA sanction 4.11 that provides that disbarment is appropriate when a lawyer knowingly converts client property and causes injury or potential injury to a client. That disbarment standard is clearly met in this case. The record evidence clearly establishes that respondent acted knowingly when he repeatedly drew client money from the trust account prior to the work being completed. This court's decisions in the Schaefer, Williams, and Ehler cases cited in our brief also support the fact that disbarment is the baseline sanction for the misappropriation of client funds. When we look at aggravators and mitigators, as we always do, there are several significant aggravators present in the case. Respondent has a significant disciplinary history, namely the fact that he had been on probation for these very same types of violations, had received training, and then no more than about 18 months later is engaging in this conduct in this case. There's a dishonest and selfish motive under the standards of the ABA standards on imposing lawyer sanctions. There's a pattern of misconduct. There are multiple violations of the ethics rules. Respondent has substantial experience in the practice of law, having been licensed since 1999. The victims in this case are vulnerable due to their dire financial conditions. These are people who hired respondent to file bankruptcies on their behalf, and in the cases charged, in many of the 1.3 diligence cases, bankruptcies aren't filed for 8, 10, 13 months, and in at least one case, never filed. So 1.3 is clearly...
Has he made any restitution?
I am not aware that there's been restitution. I think ultimately he ends up getting the bankruptcies filed, but the money's already been used prior to that work being performed. One of the problems, Judge Tattleman, is that there's not complete record keeping of the work he was doing for these clients, which led to the failure to cooperate charge, the fact that he was not forthcoming with documents that we were asking for, at least on two of the counts. In terms of mitigation, respondent has expressed remorse for the improper handling of the client funds. Nevertheless, remorse at the initiation of disciplinary investigations and proceedings should not be given, in our view, full credence and weight.
Can you tell me what was the outcome of the case of a client whose bankruptcy was never filed?
I believe that that client, ultimately, I believe the client went to someone else. I'm not sure if the funds were refunded or not, frankly, Judge Draper, but that there's at least one case where that it never gets filed. There's another case where it's filed. Money's paid in 2013, cases and filed to 2015. By the way, the respondent argues, let me address this, the diligence charges, from our point of view, are based simply on timelines. You're hired here, you file your bankruptcy here, and there's some claim on their part that this is unfair, that we should be taking into account extenuating circumstances, and that we don't carry our burden of proof under 1.3 when we simply look at timelines. In our view, in a bankruptcy case, looking at timelines is absolutely appropriate. The burden shifts to the respondent at that point to go into those extenuating circumstances. I see the time's up. I will address any other issues on rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. This case begins or should begin with Lawrence Ray. Mr. Bloom went to work for Mr. Ray in June of 2013. In order to be fair, we need to look at the entire context. When Mr. Bloom went to work there, he had been on probation for trust account violations. And as a result of that, here's the irony, is he recognized that Mr. Ray was not doing things properly in the law firm with regard to trust accounts. He didn't know how bad it was, because all he could see were some things like that the staff seemed to be running the office and making decisions that lawyers should make. Now, to be clear, Mr. Ray was still practicing, but he was not supervising and far too much delegating to staff who considered themselves to be pretty much in charge. Because Mr. Bloom recognized that there were problems here, although he did not have access to the trust account and did not know the full extent of the problems, he asked Mr. Ray to make him a partner so that he would have the authority to go in and tell the staff, who wouldn't listen to him before, tell the staff, no, you have to do it this way. And this 21-day rule that Mr. Ray had, where, you know, once we've had the money 21 days, it's ours, even, you know, in 2013, Mr. Bloom knew that was not the way that it should be handled. Now, some of the money would have been theirs most likely in these bankruptcy cases at that point. And OCDC's argument that they have to have done all the work in order to pull a flat fee out of a trust account is just incorrect. And formal opinion 128 makes that very clear, that the money can be drawn out in increments. And these were bankruptcy cases. Most of the work is done up front at the intake when they're finding out what the situation is. So we don't have situations where they hadn't done any work and they're pulling all the money out. That by intaking the case, they've done a substantial amount of the work in a bankruptcy. Because we have to look at what came into the Bloom and Ray law firm from the Ray law firm, It was important either, I believe, that Mr. Ray should have been a co-respondent in this case, as is permissible under the rules, or at least we should have been permitted discovery of what OCDC had obtained in the course of any investigation of Mr. Ray, which we had reason to believe had occurred.
I do agree with Mr. Pretzel that all these charges have to do with clients of Mr. Bloom after August of 2013, and he filed or took the cases on their behalf?
All but the one, I believe, did
so
come
why
in.
So why does it matter? I mean, those may be additional problems.
Well,
but if he took them and took flat fees and didn't file them for this long period of time, what does it matter what happened before?
Well, we are acknowledging that Mr. Bloom did make mistakes in what he tried to do in order to take care of the clients that were inherited from the Ray Law Firm, as well as new clients that came into the Bloom and Ray Law Firm. He just tried to keep things going, even though he had received $60,000 less than he should have.
But he tried to keep them going by taking money out of the trust account and putting it in his operating account.
In some instances, Mr. Bloom is responsible for that. In some instances, he had a great deal of problem with the staff there,
he's a supervisor. Did he ever report Mr. Ray for any ethical violations?
I do not believe that he reported.
Didn't he
Mr.
have an obligation to do so?
That would have been the correct thing for him to have done. I have talked to another attorney that was looking at possibly going into another situation that looked like it might be that way, and I just told that attorney, run. Let those clients fend for themselves, because you know you're not going to be given any benefit of the doubt for getting in there and trying to take care of all of those clients whose money has already been taken by Mr. Ray. So what he did was he went in and he, again, now it wasn't until he became a partner that he realized just how bad the situation was with the trust account.
But the obligation is not based on convenience, it's based on protecting the public.
It is based on protecting the public, and there's some irony there, because the right thing for him to do would have been to leave those clients of the Ray Law Firm high and dry.
Or maybe it would have been to take in no new clients until he could get a proper trust account established, not to continue taking money out of the trust account while he tried to fix up whatever Mr. Ray had done improperly.
Well, and there's no way that he could have continued to operate a law firm on no money. I'm not saying that it's right, but I'm saying that it was what it looked like to him to be the best thing for all of the clients. And the other alternative, we're talking protection of the clients, protection of Mr. Ray's clients would not have occurred had he just pulled out and reported Mr. Ray. They'd have just been left with the client security fund, which takes a long time, and these are bankruptcy clients. There was no good remedy for these clients that was going to come out of that. Yes, he made mistakes in the way he did it. He didn't do things the way that the rules required. But as far as protection of the public, he did something that was far more protection of the public. And he represented all of these people. All of these people got their representation. The one that hadn't been filed by the hearing, well, there are lots of reasons why bankruptcy cases sit for a long time after the attorney is hired. This burden-shifting idea is just ridiculous, that all you do is throw out some dates and then suddenly the attorney has the obligation. No, OCDC has to prove, and they have not proven on any of those diligence claims that
if the clients owed him any information or anything, doesn't he have an obligation to bug him about it? I mean,
I'm sorry, I
understand
couldn't hear.
He couldn't file because he doesn't have information from his clients, but don't you have an obligation to continue to seek that information so that you can proceed? And if you don't, then fire the client.
Well, yes. But sometimes clients have to wait for certain events to occur, or sometimes it's difficult to find the client to even fire them. So cases sit in bankruptcy. This is, you know, especially common where people sometimes are, you know, just ahead of their creditors and they're used to moving around and things like that. So he was doing the best he could. But to say that just throwing out some dates, okay, you were hired here and you didn't file it until here, so obviously you weren't diligent, that's not the way the system is supposed to work. The OCDC has the burden of proving that there was a lack of diligence involved in that time delay. And they simply did not do that. All they did was throw out dates. So, yes, we acknowledge that Mr. Bloom, under the rules, should have taken a different approach. But if you look at what his goal was, which was taking care of all these clients that had been clients of Mr. Ray, as well as continuing to take care of the other clients as they came in, and he did that. There really is no evidence that he failed to do that. He took care of the clients. He did have resistance from staff, and in fact, he had some dishonest staff. Now, this is not comparable to the Williams case or the Ferris case, where both Mr. Williams and Mr. Ferris knew that staff were doing things wrong with regard to the trust account and didn't address it. Mr. Bloom found out that Chelsea Hannigan had, and she testified at the hearing, basically, that she stole funds that came in from clients because the firm was having cash flow and she wanted to make sure she got paid. So she stole those funds from clients. When he found out about that, which he found about fairly quickly, he fired her. Serena Hendrickson, when he realized that she was the one who had stolen some client funds that came in, he fired her. What happened? They both immediately filed complaints and were the star witnesses for OCDC. Dishonest employees who he fired. Not the same as with the Williams case or the Ferris case. In terms of the Ayler case, which OCDC also cites, this is also not the same. He did not ignore what he had learned. His whole motive in becoming a partner was to try to implement what he had learned in what he saw in the Ray Law Firm before he became a partner. He didn't do it right. I'm not going to stand here and tell you that he didn't make any mistakes. He made some very significant mistakes, but his motivation was a good motivation. He wanted to take care of these clients, and he did take care of these clients. Now, as far as there are a couple of cases that don't fit the same mold as the rest of them in this case. There's the Kneehan's case, where he received a check that was supposed to go to a third party, but that third party payment was disputed, and the client in her deposition clearly testified, yes, I told him to dispute it. Well, he was dealing with the federal government and federal contractors, and none of us, I think that we can control the speed at which those kinds of agencies operate. He kept trying to contact them, hitting roadblocks, and eventually, by the time of the hearing, it had gotten resolved, and he testified that Ms. Kneehan was starting to get refunds of the amounts that Social Security had improperly withheld. He did not, the only allegation there, well, there's the 8.1 allegation, but there's the allegation that he, by holding on to this check, which was disputed, he did something improper. He did what the client told him to do. In Rossignol, we've got this unusual circumstance where he sends out the refund check to the client never gets it. The client came by the office unexpectedly and was able to get the letter that went out with the refund check, so we know that it was sent, and then there's a slip-up because ultimately, after waiting a certain period of time, that check is stopped payment, and a new check is issued. Presumably, just because this was such an odd circumstance, there was a slip-up, and there was a too long a period of time before the new check was sent out. But it was sent out, and the Rule 1.16 he did comply with, but there was a little delay that we don't know why it occurred. As far as the failure to respond to OCDC, and the record makes it clear from a question Mr. Schaefer-Cutter asked that, yes, this conversation that Mr. Bloom misunderstood what Mr. Schaefer-Cutter expected did occur. Mr. Bloom thought at this point, after the information was filed and an amended information was going to be filed, he thought that Mr. when he called and asked Mr. Schaefer Cutter for some more time to respond, that Mr. Schaefer Cutter said, just respond to the amended information that we're getting ready to file. Maybe that wasn't what Mr. Schaefer Cutter intended, but it was definitely what Mr. Bloom understood. And to violate 8.1, it has to be knowingly failed to respond to OCDC. He did not knowingly fail to respond. He responded as he understood was expected of him. In terms of the fraud and deceit, there are no cases of this court saying that the rules are using those words in different ways than are used in any other kinds of law in this state. There are no cases saying this is the definition of fraud for attorney discipline. The cases that are out there defining fraud and deceit are the ones that should be used. There is no indication of any representation to clients about where the trust funds would be or where the payments, the fee payments would be placed. There's no way to think that clients had some concept. In fact, I'm always having to explain to clients what I mean when I say I'm going to transfer their funds from the trust account. They don't understand what this trust account thing is. So there should be no findings that he engaged in fraud or deceit. He did not deceive anyone about what he was going to do with their fees. The trust account is now fully funded. As I understand it, I have not audited it myself, but it is fully funded. Mr. Bloom is preparing to close down his practice, and some other lawyers are either going to buy it or move into the facility that he had. I would remind you that he did express remorse, but his motives were to take care of clients. He
so
did not do this.
What's the appropriate discipline here?
I'm sorry?
What's the appropriate discipline?
I believe the appropriate discipline is a stayed suspension with probation. Again, watch, you know, to make sure that he's doing it right, but I think that you'll find that he will be doing it right. He won't put himself in this kind of a situation again, and the progressive discipline policy of this court does not require that you always escalate from the previous discipline, and you establish that in the Fork case. So we would ask for a state suspension with a period of probation.
How long?
Of how long a probation? I would think if you wanted to do an extended period of probation, typically you do a couple of years, even 3 years, something like that would be fine and appropriate. Under the circumstances. As far as the stayed suspension, I think, you know, any length of time would be appropriate as long as it stayed. So thank you. Unless there are questions? Thank you.
The appropriate sanction is disbarment. He's been on probation. He got extensive training in trust account management and control. He was under probation. He was monitored. He had a law office manager help him, train him. 18 months later, he's stealing money from clients. So I do not see this as a probation case with state suspension. It's a disbarment case, if progressive discipline means anything in Ehler. As to 8.4C, I just totally disagree with counsel regarding the need to represent to a client and fraudulently where their money's going to be kept. Chief Justice Breckinridge in the Ehler case found that Ms. Ehler violated 4-8.4C by converting client funds and that necessarily involves deceit and misrepresentation in violation of 4-8.4C. This court, in addition, 8.4C has the word dishonesty. If this wasn't dishonest conduct to take money from clients with whom you have a fiduciary responsibility and put that money where it belongs and not touch it until you've earned it, then I don't know what is dishonest, and it is deceitful, it is fraudulent. It's just that this court has never relied on civil elements of fraud and deceit to find 8.4C violations.
What elements are fraud and deceit?
Well, to me, 8.4C, Judge Teitelman, has the word dishonesty. You breach your fiduciary duty, you engage in dishonest conduct when you put money that doesn't belong to you into a trust account and then take it out because you're having cash flow problems at your law firm. I think that's dishonest. I think it's deceitful to the bar, to the public, and to your clients.
Did you agree or disagree with counsel's representation that his motive was to ultimately get all the client's cases processed, and that this was the only way he incorrectly saw to handle this, or that you think he was taking it for other reasons?
I think he saw the money there and took it because it was the easiest way for him to do it. No one was going to find out. Unfortunately, these employees filed complaints with us. He calls them our star witnesses. They weren't our star witnesses. They simply filed complaints and put us on notice that something was going on. Who was our star witness? Kelly Dillon, our auditor, who audited this account, came and testified to the misdealings with the trust account. That's who made the record for us and for this court regarding the misconduct here. I don't understand the concept of I'm doing something good for my clients by taking their money before it's been earned. Counsel mentions that most of the work in bankruptcy cases is done on intake, so you could argue that it was proper to take those funds. Not when you're either, according to his story, waiting for documents from clients, and in most of these cases, waiting 8, 10, 12, 13 months are never filing the bankruptcy. What's the objective of the client?
It's to get your bankruptcy filed. If he wanted the benefit of his work, all he had to do was keep time records, right?
Exactly. And tell us, show us what work he did. He never came across with any time records to show us this is the work I have done to earn these fees. And so, Ferris tells us, who are you going to hold that against when someone doesn't have the records they're required to have under the trust account rules? The Ferris case tells us you hold it against the lawyer. And that's what I think this court should do. I'm asking that you, I think a disbarment is appropriate in the case. Thank you.
Thank you. The case will be submitted.